Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Adam Hiller, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Reserves Management, LLC. We're here today on an appeal from the Superior Court from Sussex County in connection with a matter involving numerous areas of law. I'm sure that the Court has made itself aware that we're touching on issues of contract law, property law, lien law, even evidence. There are a lot of issues to cover at the hearing today, and so should it please the Court, I'd like to launch right into it. The first issue that appellant has with the rulings of the Superior Court is that Judge Bradley, we think, did a very good job of trying to parse through a lot of facts and a lot of issues that were raised by the parties on summary judgment, but the procedural side of summary judgment was not respected, and it is the appellant's view that this Court should either overturn that decision by the Superior Court and, in fact, direct the Superior Court to enter judgment on...
Your contention is that there are material facts in dispute that create a triable issue?
That is part of our contention. The other part of our contention is that in order to determine what is a material dispute of fact, one must first have evidence of record evidencing the facts that each party is putting forward. Your Honors, our client has put forward two affidavits, not including the affidavits that supported the complaint, or complaints, that evidenced in substantial detail a number of transactions and facts.
Let me try to boil that down. You're saying that as to the claim on which judgment was entered against your client, there was no evidence. That's part of the argument.
Your Honor, that is correct.
And as to other elements of the claim, or one or more of the other elements of that same claim, there was evidence, but it was disputed. Is that right?
Your Honor, there's only one potential fact that we contend could be a dispute of material fact that should have justified the...
And it is.
And that is whether or not appellant permitted the transfer of the properties in the first instance from RT Properties, which is the holding company, to each of the four subsidiary appellees, which are the subsidiary entities. There were 17 lots, and they were divided among four subsidiaries, and that itself was one of many breaches of the contract of sale that we contend, if in fact you get to the contract of sale, would prevent the appellees from relying upon that as a basis for not having to pay the assessments.
Well, let me make sure I understand that. Is it the question of whether they permitted or not that transfer? Is that the fact in dispute? Because there can't be any factual dispute. They either were or weren't transferred.
You're correct. There's no dispute about whether they were transferred. The sale contract says that, among other things, that RT Properties would not transfer the properties without, and I'll say this colloquially, without the consent of the appellant. And one of the only facts of evidence in the affidavit submitted by the appellees was that the appellant did in fact consent or permit that transfer, whereas the affidavit submitted by our client indicated that it was not permitted and in fact was not known to our client at the time that that transfer occurred.
Okay.
How do you work Rule 56 into the argument as it's currently written? And these were cross motions for summary judgment, which means each side is saying there's no issue of material fact. Rule in my favor on summary judgment.
Correct.
And the last subsection of Rule 56, which was not cited by either you or your opponent, provides if you have cross motions for summary judgment and you're not going to raise a material issue of fact, it constitutes a stipulation to decide the case on a paper record.
Your Honor, the problem with the cross motions for summary judgment format in this case was that the issues and facts that were raised in the original, in our client's summary judgment motion, relied upon everything stopping at the covenant level. The issue became, from the appellee's side, that they introduced new facts of record, and they weren't even of record. They were just introduced in the form of argument that allowed, or they contended, allowed a forbearance of the requirement to pay the assessments under the covenants.
I understand that, but under the rule, somebody's got to tell the judge, we have cross motions for summary judgment, And we know the rule says it constitutes a stipulation to decide it on a paper record, but that's not what we want you to do. Did anyone tell Judge Bradley that?
Yes, Your Honor. That actually was raised at the hearing on the summary judgment motion. It was also stated in our reply brief.
All right. Go ahead.
To follow up on the Chief Justice's question, there's no dispute that the properties were transferred to four newly created subsidiaries.
Correct.
And the issue that you contend is disputed is whether that was done with the consent of your client, Reserves Management?
That, Your Honor, is the only, we contend, the only disputed material fact of record, yes.
Okay. Well, this was done openly and notoriously, was it? I mean, is there evidence that your client didn't know for all of these years that that had been done?
Your Honor, it's not a question of knowledge. It's a question of that constituting a breach of the sale contract.
No, that's not the way you phrased the question, though. The question is, was that transfer made with the consent of your client? As I understand the record, your client knew either at the time or shortly after that that had happened, and there was never raised any objection to it. So there's at least, a very strong inference of consent. So on summary judgment, it's your side's obligation to rebut that inference with contrary evidence. What is it?
Your Honor, in the actual affidavit of Mr. Kuratke, he did state that he was not aware of it at that time. And the fact that a breach had occurred does not, the waiver of a breach that had occurred does not occur unless it was waived in writing under the sale contract.
So basically the dispute, or the record source of the dispute, is your client's affidavit, some would say self-serving, that he didn't know at the time that this this distribution of the properties to the four subsidiaries had occurred?
Your Honor, yes. The question becomes, would it
sorry,
may be self-serving.
Is the answer yes or no?
Certainly, yes.
Okay. Is there any other evidence?
I think the other evidence is the lack of evidence in response.
Well, how can evidence be a lack of evidence?
Well, unlike everything else of record in this case, this one potential material fact is disputed between the two parties' affidavits. And in that instance, we contend that the matter should be sent to trial, if that, in fact, is material. Now, we've contended for a number of different reasons at a number of different levels that it isn't material, because we believe, among other things, that the sale contract does not contain a provision of forbearance. The sale contract is not enforceable by the subsidiary appellees. We don't believe that the sale contract is binding upon the appellant, who is not a party to it. We don't believe that the...
Is there any evidence or anything in the record that suggests that your client's consent, whether he gave it or not, was required?
Was required under...
Was required.
Yes, Your Honor, that is directly in the sale contract.
And what's the source? Yeah, you claimed that his consent was required.
His consent was required under the sale contract. That would be a breach of the sale contract for them to transfer, for RT Properties to transfer the lots to third parties without the consent of our client.
And what provision of the sale contract required his consent?
Your Honor, I believe that would be paragraph 11J. Court would just give me one moment so that I can confirm that. It's in paragraph 11, and I apologize for not having the subsection in front of me. Your Honor, it's in paragraph 11. It's in paragraph 11, but I can't put my finger on the specific subsection.
You can't put your finger on the text of
No, Your Honor, I, at the moment I cannot.
Well, when you get up and reply, perhaps you can fill us in with that information, since, one of your opening argument is that summary judgment shouldn't have been granted because there's a dispute of fact, and we're trying to isolate what the fact is in this evidentiary source of the dispute.
Certainly, Your Honor. Again, though, what we contend is that that would only be a dispute of material fact to the extent that the court finds the sale contract itself to be material, to the extent that the court finds that the sale contract is binding upon the appellant, to the extent that it finds that it is binding on behalf of the subsidiary appellees. There are a lot of different levels that you have to pass before you can get to the question of when the transfer of the lots occurred, was there consent? And then you have this question of a disputed fact over whether there was consent.
Perhaps you can turn directly to your belief that the trial judge erred and tell us why he erred and what we need to do about it.
Your Honor, the trial judge erred because, but for that very short affidavit of Mr. Tranovich, there was no record made by the defendant, by the appellees as to any basis for them to be excused or have a deferment from having to pay the assessments that are due under these covenants. There was not even a record made of the contract of sale itself. We obviously argued the potential issues that may have arisen from that so as not to waive any arguments on that point. But there was literally no record made of that. And if you look at the admissions, the answers to interrogatories, the depositions, and the other materials that have evidentiary quality, and this is not just a technical requirement. I mean, these are so that the parties put forth evidence for the trial court to determine that there are or are not disputes of material fact. If you look at the materials that were submitted by the appellees, you will find that there's virtually no factual record made by the defendant. And what you have is a set of covenants for which there is evidence that provide for certain assessments for which there is evidence that they were not paid, again, for which there was no evidence, and that those amounts constituted a lien the moment they arose on each of the respective lots that were subject to those assessments. All of that is of record, and there are virtually no facts to contest that other than the question of whether the property was transferred and a vague statement by Mr. Tranovich about representations that appear to have been made by the appellant before the contract was executed.
Well, listen, there's more than a vague statement by Mr. Tranovich. There's also your own client's principal's deposition testimony to the effect that there was forbearance until the properties were sold to a third-party purchaser.
You're quite right, Your Honor, and there were certainly some statements made by Mr. Kroenke, who is a non-practicing, non-Delaware lawyer, and unfortunately, during the deposition, some of the questions tended to stray from facts and started to stray towards legal principles, and there were objections placed on the record on that. And the
you just characterized your own client's deposition testimony. What's the basis for that?
Well, he wasn't called to testify as an expert. He was noticed to testify.
He testified as a party that negotiated the deal.
Your Honor, there certainly were statements of Mr. Kroenke's intention not immediately to go after these assessments. There's no question about that. The questions that were raised at the deposition, though, and that, number one, I believe it was important for the trial court to resolve the evidentiary objection as to the propriety of the question. That itself, I think, would be reversible error, especially when you're going to rely on that testimony. But secondly, there was no testimony as to the permanency of a forbearance. In other words, Judge Bradley found that because Mr. Kroenke had testified and used the word forbearance, that this was, in fact, akin to a forbearance agreement that you see in finance law, where a mortgage company enters into a formal forbearance agreement that lasts a specific period of time, or in this case, forever. Mr. Kroenke's deposition testimony or affidavit refutes that. There was not a statement that this was supposed to last forever, but that was imputed and, in fact, was arguably one of the more significant bases for Judge Bradley's entry of summary judgment against our client.
Now, when these 17 lots were transferred, they were all paid for, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. They had been, when they were initially transferred to RT Properties, I believe is when the purchase price was paid. That's my understanding. I don't know if that's of record, but
there's a record show that was over $4 million.
I don't know, and I don't believe it's of record how much was paid, other than maybe that it was in the contract of sale. There was no dispute. As far as I know, there was no assertion by our client that RT Properties did not pay the purchase price.
To follow up on Justice Holland's question, at the time that the properties were redistributed to the four subsidiaries, your client's position is that that was done without Mr. Crockton's consent, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the evidentiary basis for that contention is his affidavit.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the affidavit explain why it mattered to him? That is, why he would have cared at all whether or not he consented?
Your Honor, the affidavit did not.
Is it fair to say that it's just a conclusory affidavit?
No, it's not clear. It's not fair to say that, Your Honor. The consent itself.
That doesn't say any more than that this was done without my consent.
The affidavit does not.
Extent, it's conclusory.
But the contract doesn't require any statement as to the basis for withholding of consent. It simply requires the consent of the appellant. Your Honors, I apologize, but I'm eating to my rebuttal time, so if I could reserve
it. Save it, that's fine.
Any time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Timothy Martin on behalf of the appellees in this case. Your Honors, this is a case about the plaintiff trying to recover fees from my client that it did not contractually agree to pay for, that these were part of the sales agreement, that a forbearance had been agreed upon by RT Properties and Reserves Development Company to forbear when those assessments were due and to pass them along to the ultimate home buyer. If I may just to hopefully answer some of Your Honor's questions that were raised to Mr. Hiller, in particular the consent argument that Justice Jacobs raised. The provision of the sales agreement that the appellant relies upon has been paragraph 3 of the sales agreement, which talks about the transfer of control of the purchaser and that being required consent. However, there's also paragraph 11A, which says that the purchaser may, without the consent of the developer, transfer the properties to a subsidiary, which is exactly what happened here in this case, is that the properties were transferred.
You're saying paragraph 12 allows what happened here?
11A, yes, Your Honor. If Your Honor would be so inclined, 11A states in relevant part, subject to the provisions hereof, the terms and provisions hereof shall be binding upon and inure to the benefit of the heirs, executors, administrators, successors, and assigns of the parties hereto. This agreement shall not be assigned by purchaser except to its affiliates, directly or by transfer of ownership in or control of the purchaser, without seller's prior written consent, which may be withheld for any reason or no reason. Thus, the transfer to a subsidiary is actually contemplated in the sales agreement, much as is stated in Mr. Tranovich's affidavit, which was used in support of the motion for summary judgment, where it was always his intention to have these four subsidiary defendants have title to the property. One thing that's also important to note when we talk about the actual forbearance here in this agreement, and respectfully, I know we jumped into the argument, but we certainly believe that the trial court's decision should be affirmed for the following reasons. One, the sales agreement is clear on its face and that it provides for forbearance that until a certificate of occupancy is issued and...
Well, the problem with that argument is that the agreement talks about the liability of a third-party purchaser for all of these assessments going forward, that is, from the moment the third-party purchaser purchases the house. It doesn't really address, at least I don't read it as clearly addressing the liability for the assessments between the point in time that your clients took title and the point in time in which they actually sold a completed home to the third-party purchaser.
Your Honor, respectfully, we believe that the trial court's decision on this issue was correct in that the provision in the sales agreement states, the paragraph that's really at issue is paragraph 11 of the sales agreement. entitled Homeowner Obligations. The paragraph starts out by stating that at the time that the party, at the time that the home is built and sold to a third party, that the purchaser, and in this case RT Properties, is obligated to provide a copy of the restrictive covenants to the ultimate purchaser. It then goes on to continue. Purchaser acknowledges that at the time a lot is sold by the purchaser to a third party and a certificate of occupancy is issued, the third party purchaser shall become liable for, and it's not just, Your Honor, the quarterly slash annual assessments, but it also goes to the initial one-time assessments for the
Okay, and I'm asking you, where in the text is it clear that the third-party purchaser, homeowner, has to reach back to the beginning of time and pay those assessments?
Well, it would not go back to the beginning of time, Your Honor, under the sales agreement. I'll answer both parts. Firstly,
I understand there may be testimony to that effect, but I'm just asking whether the agreement, you know, in isolation, provides that.
Certainly. Well, with regards to going back for all time, as Your Honor stated, the relevant provision of the paragraph says, with regards to the annual assessments, the quarterly dues, that the homeowners, that they become liable for those moving forward. So it would not go back in time for those assessments, for the annual upkeep assessments, as you would call. As far as the other one-time initial assessments, it would go to, Your Honor, with the obligation that the purchaser, in this case RT Properties, has an obligation to pass along, that they would have the obligation to give that to any type of third-party purchaser. By the agreement saying that the third-party purchaser, the ultimate home buyer, is responsible for that, those one-time assessments, that document, we believe that in the sales agreement, that would be the provision that would require RT Properties to provide the notice to the home buyer. Your Honor, it's beyond just what we believe the trial court interpreting the contract correctly as providing for this forbearance. The trial court did an additional exercise in that if the four corners of the sales agreement were not correct, it looked to the parole evidence. And here's where the trial court found ample evidence to support the appellee's position that, in fact, there was a forbearance. As Justice Jacobs raised in the initial discussion with the appellant's counsel, here my clients noticed a 30B6 deposition of Reserves Management Corporation. One of the principal issues was looking at the timing of the assessments. Not surprisingly, the person who was identified as a 30B6 witness was Mr. Abraham Karaki. Mr. Abraham Karaki is the sole managing member of Reserves Management. He is also the sole managing member of Reserves Development. This is where the trial court said Mr. Karaki knew what was going on. As Mr. Karaki stated in his own deposition with regards to the management company, the buck stopped with him. He testified, while he is not a member of the Delaware Bar, he certainly is a trained attorney and knows the significance of words that he would use and the significance of the deposition. He testified when asked if there was anything in the contract that altered the timing of the assessments. He was the one who first said, oh, the forbearance agreement. So he was specifically asked which part of the document referred to that, and it was the provision that required a certificate of occupancy to be issued and the transfer of the properties to a third party. He continued on to say that not only was there a forbearance, but he described the benefit, that it was for the benefit of the home builder. He said that this was to continue until a single-family home was built. And then he stated that it continued as long as there was a good faith basis to do so. Nowhere in the contract is there anything that gives him the unilateral ability to forego the forbearance.
Well, that's where I have a little difficulty. There certainly is a thread running through the other side's argument that even if there was an agreement to forbear, requiring the appellee entities to pay the assessments as they accrued, that was with the understanding that those assessments, that is all the assessments that accrued during the period that the appellees owned the properties, until they sold the properties to a third party, the understanding was that there would be the development of these homes and the sale of those homes to third parties. The argument appears to be that at some point Mr. Kerotkin realized there wasn't going to be any development. Those properties were not going to have any homes constructed on them, and therefore there would be no sales. And at that point, he said that there was no longer any good faith basis to continue the forbearance. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, Your Honor, it's a couple of fault.
And let me ask it a little bit more precisely.
Certainly.
How did the lower court deal with that argument? And, is that argument properly a matter of law, or is it a matter of an issue of fact?
Well, Your Honor, essentially, if I understand Your Honor's question correctly, it gets to the plaintiff's argument that there was a breach of contract. And part of the breach under the appellant's argument is that no homes were built, which is also interesting from the standpoint that is a subject of another case involving similar parties that is also pending in Sussex County of whether there was a breach. One of the things with regards to the appellant's argument that there was a breach, one of the things that they rely upon as kind of the indication that and support for the fact that to cancel the forbearance is this bank record, these bank records that were received in this other litigation. Well, based upon the documents as they were produced, those documents did not even come into arguably the appellant's position, but Reserve Development Corporation's possession until October of 2010. That is 1 year after the plaintiff had unilaterally chosen to end the forbearance.
Was the claim that's being made by Mr. Kerotkin or his management company a claim that came into existence or that was first asserted after the bankruptcy?
I'm sorry, could you repeat your question, Your Honor?
Did the bankruptcy occur before the claim that gave rise to this lawsuit was asserted?
The bankruptcy has recently occurred within the last 6 or 8 months, I believe, Your Honor. I don't know the exact fine of the petition.
Okay,
date.
So the claim for all of the back assessments was asserted before the bankruptcy, and this
yes,
lawsuit was filed and was prosecuted before the bankruptcy?
Yes, Your Honor. This case was filed prior to the bankruptcy, yes, Your Honor. With regards to the fact that that the homes have not been built, one thing to keep in mind with regards, as this court is certainly familiar with the facts of this case, and as Judge Bradley held in the lower court, getting back to your question, Justice Jacobs, that neither of the parties really contemplated this development taking so long. However, based upon the fact that there is no requirement in which for my clients to build homes within a specific period of time, that's what we believe weakens the plaintiff's breach of contract argument.
Can I ask you a question before you finish that argument? You used a phrase that intrigues me. You said that Mr. Karate or his company unilaterally canceled the forbearance. At least I think that's what you said.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm confused about that. If under the relationship between the parties, he could decide not to collect what he was otherwise owed, why would he need the other side's agreement to cancel his forbearance? Why isn't the fact that it's unilateral perfectly understandable?
Certainly, Your Honor, because we believe that under the language of the sales agreement, which is also echoed by Mr. Karanke's own testimony, that the forbearance was to remain in effect until it was transferred to a third party and the issuance of a certificate of occupancy. Those would be the two conditions which would allow the forbearance to go away for the plaintiff to be able to raise the assessments and to issue the assessments.
Well, what other consideration was exchanged for that condition?
Your Honor, that would be part of the sales agreement. That was the negotiated sales agreement between RT Properties and Reserves Development Corporation.
So the sales agreement speaks to forbearance?
Well, that is, Your Honor, that is really the issue between my client's position and Mr. Hiller's position, the appellant. That is, we believe that under the sales agreement, paragraph 10 is the forbearance agreement. It's also echoed by the fact that when I asked Mr. Kuraki, is there a provision which alters the timing of the assessments, he referred to that particular paragraph in the sales agreement.
Paragraph 10?
Yes, Your Honor. So for that reason, we do believe that it was a negotiated part of the contract.
Is it paragraph 10 or paragraph 11?
Paragraph 10 is the homeowner's obligations that speaks to the timing of the assessments and the forbearance. One of the things that I think is important to note as well, as the plaintiff has argued in their paperwork, that that the reserves management is not a party to the contract. And this was touched upon by the trial court, and I don't know if the appellant's going to raise it in rebuttal, so I want to make sure it is addressed. This is where the trial court said Mr. Kuraki, as the head of both entities, he was there just as if and was a party to the contract on behalf of reserves management and reserves development. And what also is important to note is the interplay that is frequently used on behalf of the plaintiff or the appellant, in that they refer to the declarant and also reserves management almost interchangeably in a sort. For example, in the response to the court's request for additional information at the summary judgment level, the court asked, well, what was the purpose of paragraph 10? And in that, in their response, the plaintiff slash appellant said that it was the declarant who made the who set forth the agreement not to pursue the agreement. Thus, the reserves management is indicating that the declarant had power to do this. Mr. Kuraki, during his 30B6 deposition, said also that he had the ability and that there was a forbearance. So when you're looking at the situation, Mr. Kuraki, as the trial...
Let me jump ahead just for a second. Jumping ahead, that is, to the unilateral termination by Mr. Kuraki of the forbearance.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the record reflect, at the time that termination took place, any exchange of correspondence between Mr. Kuraki and the principals of the other side?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the way that my client received notice,
I would have thought that Mr. Kuraki would say, I'm terminating this forbearance. Our understanding was, and then it would state what the understanding was, that hasn't occurred. You're in breach. Therefore, you're no longer entitled to forbearance. And one would have expected a reply from your client saying you're wrong because. What's the record show?
Your Honor, my recollection of the record is that the first notice that my client received of the end of the forbearance was receiving an invoice on or about August 24th of 2009 for $517,778.
Okay, so Mr. Kuraki sent an invoice for $500,000. What did your client do in response? That is, what communication was made in response?
Your Honor, I don't recall specifically whether the record includes any, and I don't believe it does include any specific communication. At the time, it's interesting. It's notable to also remind the court that Reserves Development Corporation and RT Properties were also engaged in litigation.
It would be all the more reason for them to write a formal letter expressing their opposition to the claim that they owed $500,000 plus.
And, Your Honor, I certainly understand where Your Honor is coming from, but as far as the record in this case, I do not believe that there was a formal letter that was issued in response. Certainly, I'm sure the appellant will correct me if I'm wrong, but I do not believe
So the trial judge found, as a matter of law, that essentially what the parties agreed to is, by forbearance, is that your clients would under no circumstances be required to pay the assessments.
Correct, Your Honor.
The understanding was that there would be, that whatever liability there was would be triggered by the construction and later the sale of homes to third parties with the certificate of occupancy. But even if that didn't occur, it was basically an open-ended agreement that under no circumstances would your clients be taxed with that liability. Is that fair?
That is a fair assessment, Your Honor.
Okay, and that to rule that as a matter of law requires a record of some kind, does it not?
It does, Your Honor, and the record that the trial court based its decision off of was both the actual language of the sales agreement, which called for those two conditions to be met prior to the issuance of assessments against my client.
And what else?
And also then when the court looked to the parole evidence and looked at the actual statements by Mr. Karaki, they looked at the parties' interactions. They looked at the fact that when RT Properties first came into possession of the properties, there was no payment for the assessments. No invoice was assessed for my clients. And in fact,
that may be consistent with there being a forbearance during the time that Mr. Karaki was under the impression that there would be a construction and later sale of the homes. What in the record factually establishes that the parties never intended your clients would be liable for the assessments under any circumstances, even if there were no home constructions and sales?
Well, as far as the record goes, Your Honor, I believe the trial court looked to the actual plain terms of the sales agreement.
So you fall back on the sales agreement?
Yes, Your Honor.
Paragraph 10?
Yes, Your Honor.
Paragraph 10 refers to the liability of the third-party purchasers or homeowners from that time forward.
Correct, Your Honor.
It doesn't look backward, and that's why I have a problem with paragraph 10 of the agreement, if that's the sole support.
Your Honor, I see that my time is up. I don't.
You should answer Justice Jacobs' question, though.
Thank you, Your Honor. The problem here is that as the trial court held, when the time that the parties had entered into this contract, the parties believed that everything was going to move forward and move forward quickly. However, due to various reasons, it never went through. There's nothing in the sales agreement that grants Mr. Karaki the ability to cancel the forbearance. Just like Your Honor has asked whether there's anything that says that he cannot, there's also nothing in there, Your Honor, that we would submit that he can cancel the forbearance.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court again, Adam Hiller on behalf of the appellant in rebuttal. To address a couple of points that were raised by my opposing counsel, one of the themes that has not been addressed at all in this argument but is important for the court to consider is the concept of the assessment lien. What happens is under the covenant, at the moment an assessment comes due, it becomes a lien under the covenant itself. And as the court may recall from the Henlopen decision, which is old but continues to be good law as near as we can tell in this jurisdiction, that lien is respected. That could occur. That occurs at the time the assessment is due and can be recovered at any point from the time the lien attaches forward. So there's no basis to assert that nothing came due at that time. Now let's talk for just a minute, because I want to catch a few things before I run out of time, about the common ownership between the declarant on one side, which is also, I will call colloquially, the developer, and the management company on the other side. Yes, both LLCs are managed and owned by the same individual, Mr. Karaki, but they serve very different purposes. The development side of things was what I would call a for-profit venture. It was there specifically for the developer to capitalize on the value of real estate. That's what developers do. The management side is different. The management company was created in lieu of a homeowners association. It does have a fixed 15% right to recover the services it provides based on what it expends, although the record shows it never actually collected that 15%. But that is what benefits the community. Mr. Karaki operates that entity, or at least operated it up until the bankruptcy converted, for the benefit of the community. It's not anything beyond a contractual relationship, but you can't understate the importance of that. Every dollar that's not paid by the appellees ends up getting billed to the other homeowners, and they end up paying more than their respective shares.
That may be the case, but the argument is that's what these parties agreed to.
Well, except that the management company was not a party to the sale contract, and, Your Honor, frankly, the bankruptcy actually is a perfect illustration of why that matters, because now the companies arguably are not under the same control, or may soon not be under the same control, depending on what Delaware law provides once a a single-member LLC ends up in a Chapter 7 case. It's not impossible that at this point a Chapter 7 trustee can or may have the power or may not, depending on what happens, to administer the management company's services, which means that a contract that the management company did not execute is now being asserted as a defense against the management company's rights under the covenant. That contract was not recorded. Yes, Mr. Kuraki was aware of it. We're not arguing that Mr. Kuraki somehow forgot about it when he was managing the management company and that he remembered it when he was the development company. But it's not a matter of knowledge. If you have two affiliates and one of them knows that the other has entered into a contract, the other affiliate is not bound to that contract, and we have sophisticated parties. The other thing I wanted to mention is that the two conditions for the alleged forbearance, I'm just calling it forbearance colloquially, but the two conditions, one of which is the issuance of a certificate of occupancy, that matter is exclusively within the appellee's control. The appellees are the ones that have to build a house. Once they've constructed a home under the paragraph 3 of the contract, then they can get a certificate of occupancy. They can put off forever the obligation to pay those assessments if their argument is correct under this agreement, simply by deciding or choosing never to construct a home.
Well, the trial court found that as a real-world matter, it would not be forever, that one way or the other, that the issue was going to be resolved.
I'm out of time. May I respond
answer
to the Justice's
question?
Your Honor, the trial court made a what I would call a pragmatic decision that at some point the issue will likely be resolved, but what happens if it is not? I mean, we have a bankruptcy right now that the developer and Mr. Kuraki are in, where to the extent that there is a breach of the contract by the developer, that may become a claim in the bankruptcy, and depending on how claims are treated, that may never, ever be litigated. So what that basically does is leave the management company, which again is akin to a homeowners association, although it isn't a democratic organization the way many homeowners associations are, but that leaves the management company essentially without a remedy. And once the developer entity is shut down, if that in fact is one possible outcome of this, then that leaves the management company with a permanently without a remedy, because now you have the owner of 17 lots in this community, roughly 10% of the community, who is not obligated to kick in their fair share, whereas the other ones have to.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll
thank
take
you,
the
Honest.
Case under advisement and recess.